Sayago, I'm John Cain, and this is Resistance Radio. Hey, I'm going to start this program just as I'm going to end it. And I'm going to start by asking you once again, as I do, and frankly, all of us producers do, we ask that you support the radio stations that this show appears on, and that's WBAI in New York City and WPFW in Washington, D.C. If you are listening on Facebook Live, feel free to contribute to either one of those stations, or both the stations for that matter, as far as that goes. We also post this show up as a podcast. So regardless of how you're listening, but specifically if you are listening in Washington or New York, please do support the stations. If you're listening in New York, the number to call is 212-209-2950, or go online to give2wbai.org. If you're listening in Washington, the number to call there is 202-588-9739, or go online to wpfwfm.org. Hey, look, we'd love you to make a donation of any size, but one of the things that we try to encourage our listeners to do is to become sustainable members. And with WBAI, we call it the Buddy Program. And frankly, we're kind of being told as producers, we need to sign up a significant number of buddies to make our shows sustainable for the station. Now, it's I don't know how much of it's a loaded threat or if it's just a facts of the matter that if we can't afford to, if we can't generate enough revenue on the hour that I'm on the air, then yeah, I don't know if the stations are that committed to having us on. So again, sustainable membership is really an easier way to go. It's not such heavy lifting. If you want to do, you know, $5, $10, $20, $30, $50 a month, then you can go online to either one of those websites, give2wbai.org or wpfwfm.org, and follow the prompts to become a sustainable member, or as like I said, in with WBAI, they call it the Buddy Program. Love to have some buddies. So I'm asking you to support the station. And look, I did an event this past weekend up in Mount Vernon, and it was called basically At the Root of It All, Legacies of Colonization from Mount Vernon to Palestine. And invariably, and I'm not saying this is a terrible criticism, but invariably somebody did a land acknowledgement. And they also talked about how they did land acknowledgments at the university that the one speaker works at. And I got to say, look, if you are made to feel better, you feel better because you do a land acknowledgement, but you don't do anything else, I'm saying make a donation. You know, I, like I said, where's the check? And I'm not asking you to send me money. I'm really not. But I am asking, again, if you're one of those people who feel like land acknowledgments are so important and maybe they relieve a little white guilt, I don't know. But I'm not saying don't do them, but if you're going to do them, then make sure you accompany that land acknowledgement, that acknowledgement about who Native people are and the fact that wherever you're living and whoever you are, you're living on land that was once occupied. It was the home of Native people before much calamity took place. So, look, am I saying that you owe us something? Well, that's for you to decide. But if you feel a debt, if you feel an obligation, land acknowledgments don't solve the problem. But you know what? Giving a space, whether it's land back as one of our movements, or whether it's space on a radio dial. And the only way that I can secure the space on the radio dial is by you supporting the stations that air this program. So I'm sorry if it seems a little cheap for me to connect land acknowledgement with making a donation to WBAI and WPFW. No, it's not. It's not. I'm asking that you step up. And again, by all means, let a land acknowledgement make you feel a little better. Let it relieve some of the guilt that frankly, anybody who's lived a prosperous life in the United States should feel a little bit of an obligation, not just to Native people, but to other people who were oppressed that created the opportunity for that, for their affluence or their opportunities to be realized. So we'll stop there with that, but I will come back at the end of the program and ask you again. So remember, again, the pledge lines for WBAI is 212-209-2950. For WPFW, it's 202-588-9739. And look, if I go off the air, it's because enough of you didn't step up. If WBAI or WPFW goes off the air, it's because enough of you didn't step up. You know, I'm not saying there aren't other issues, but first and foremost, we depend on you. Your contributions are what keeps these stations alive and gives me the opportunity to come to you each week. All right, this week. Well, today marks it's a terrible anniversary. But I think it's important to bring it up. 56 years ago today, 1968, on this day, Martin Luther King was assassinated. And as tragic as that event was or is, there's a list of names that comes to mind. George Floyd, Breonna Taylor, Tamir Rice, Freddie Gray, Michael Brown, Sandra Bland, Eric Garner, and the list goes on. And I'm just talking about folks, black folks like Martin Luther King, who were killed, not by some conspiracy of declared white supremacists, no, by cops. And the fact that we still have this problem today makes me question everything about anyone who's going to suggest that we have somehow advanced as a society. And look, and I'm joining you on this one. You know, I'm always talking about how I want distinction and autonomy and sovereignty and that kind of stuff. But I know we still share a certain legacy. We still share a certain amount of psychosocial activity. And when I see this list of black men, black women, who are essentially murdered, let's call it what it is, murdered because of an underlying racial bias that exists in law enforcement. And I'd be remiss if I didn't mention, as I always have to, that Native people, even though we're a very, very small population, as a percentage of our population, we actually die death by cop at a higher rate than anybody. I mean, the only demographic in that 16 to 21-year-olds, black men surpassed Native men in terms of death by cop. But if you, in the overall, body of age groups, Native people die in death by cop at a higher rate than anybody. And look, I'm not trying to compete for this title, but it's just a matter of fact. So, I mean, why does this happen? And what is the current trend line? And look, there was a lot of brouhaha after George Floyd and Breonna Taylor and others to do police reform, to do more training in terms of diversity, equity, inclusion. That's all going backwards now, folks. I'm going to tell you, listeners of these two stations, regardless of who you vote for, you are about to participate in an election where Donald Trump is going to reclaim the presidency. Unless something dramatic happens. Like, I don't know, maybe Biden decides to cut off military aid to Israel. Which, if you believe that's going to happen, well, I hope the Easter Bunny was good to you last weekend. I mean, this is where we are. And this is where you are. And of course, I'm impacted by all this stuff. And I'm impacted regardless of what party puts somebody in these offices, because frankly, either party, kind of makes a mockery of much of what you would consider to be social justice. As I said, I traveled to down to Yonkers and over to Mount Vernon last weekend to speak at a conference called At the Root of It All, Legacies of Colonization from Mount Vernon to Palestine. And the reason it's worded that way, it's to include the impacts of colonization on Native people, just like the impacts of colonization is happening to the Palestinians in Gaza. The thing that I had to address right away and continue to address is that the impacts of colonization to Native people didn't end with colonization. We're still being impacted by it today. And I was glad to have the opportunity to speak to a crowd and a live audience and have that kind of interaction. It was good. And I also got to thank a few of the listeners to this show, Ralph and Beth and Howard, for coming out. And it was good to kind of see you guys for the first time in person, because you guys have been listening and commenting on my Facebook pages and that kind of stuff. So it was good to see you, but it was good to see everybody. And it was good to be in a crowd where we talked about the power of the black community stepping up on an issue that's not just about here. It's about colonization. And to have the Palestinian guest, speak about her experience. And to be included in that conversation, I appreciated that. Because at the end of the day, we can't talk about injustice, especially in the United States, if we're not going to talk about the two most clear and most devastating lack of justice that occurred in this country. And that's slavery and slavery of black people and the genocide of Native people. And that's not to say that black people didn't experience genocide and that Native people didn't experience slavery. We did. They did. You did. But we kind of, it's easier to acknowledge the impacts that chattel slavery had on black people, and it's certainly easier to acknowledge the impact that genocide has had on Native people. So again, getting back to the assassination of Martin Luther King, it tears me up to think how little progress we've made since then. But you know, the problem is that we have a strange way of measuring progress. I mean, I think about Brown versus the Board of Education in the 1950s. The same court that overturned separate but equal made one of the most racist rulings in the case against the Keaton Native people, where they were trying to get either put a damper on or at least get paid for the logging of the trees that would be taken off their lands. And they were basically told, no, you don't own that stuff. They doubled down on the doctrine of discovery. This is the same court that overturned, again, Brown versus the Board of Education. So we can look at something and say, oh, look at that progress. But if you don't look at a bigger picture, this is why I always talk about siloing. If you don't put everything into the context of the rest of what's happening in the world, in that contemporary moment, then you can spin progress any way you want. I said last week I was going to talk about missing and murdered Indigenous women, and I do want to address that, because it's kind of a symptom of the same levels of racism and bigotry and conditioning of the general public of the American public. I mean, it's amazing to me how people don't understand what was wrong with Aunt Jemima on a pancake box or a syrup bottle, or Uncle Ben, or even the Native maiden, the Indian maiden on the Land O'Lakes butter. We weren't a part of those products. I know there's all kinds of BS stories about the woman who played Aunt Jemima. No, she was hired. She didn't own the company. She didn't have her own recipe. None of that. All that stuff is BS. It's all made up. You can believe what you want to believe, but if you want to research it, then research it. And don't just base it on somebody's post on the internet or something like that. Do your own thorough research, and then you'll know that was a character created by by that company, and they plugged several black women into it. And what did they do? They did the whole mammy thing. Looked like somebody straight out of pulled out of the plantation to be the house Negro. That's exactly what they did. Same thing with Uncle Ben. Well. And the Land O'Lakes butter, that wasn't our land they were talking about. That was land that was stolen long before they started making butter out of that place. I mean, the Native woman on that package had nothing to do with butter. So, but see, this is the conditioning, right? Now, I hear white people, look at what they did to that. They took the Indian girl off the butter. Look what they did. And they want to get all self-righteous, like they somehow have this... this social mandate to stick up for the black woman on the Aunt Jemima bottle. Are you freaking kidding me? We have done this thing in this country between Hollywood and, frankly, magazines, newsprint, TV, of course, where we've created these images that aren't even close to the truth. And Native people experience all the time. That's what the whole mascot thing is all about. But what they've done is they've objectified people. And whether it's black people, in the case of those two products, or whether we talk about people in general. So I can't talk about missing and murdered indigenous women if I don't talk about the sexual objectification of women, Native women in particular. The rape culture that came with the first ship that landed on the shores of this hemisphere. I said it before, James Cook, the famed cartographer, the map maker for the United Kingdom, he wrote in his journal about his concern about his men going ashore when they discovered Hawaii and a population that was there. He was concerned because he knew that his men were laced with venereal disease and that a significant percentage of that population would die if his men went on shore. He knew that women were going to get raped. He knew that our resistance to venereal disease carried by these Europeans was low. Oh, everybody wants to talk about influenza and smallpox and everything else. No, the first wave of death by disease came with the rape culture of Europeans. And that hasn't ended, folks. We see it all the time with the sexualization of women. Women of color, and I hate to use such a broad expression, but whether it's black women or Native women, or you know, or brown women, I mean, whatever color you want to consider somebody, you see it's even worse. Native women have the highest percentage of likelihood of experiencing a sexual assault of any other people that could be determined in American society. By far, it's not even close. When Gabby Petito turned up missing because her boyfriend had murdered her, it was on the news every freaking night. Look, and I think it's dreadful what happened to that poor girl. But the pretty blonde girl who did blog posts on traveling got all kinds of attention. The Native women who turned up missing from the same locations, basically, never got an ounce of coverage in the media. So let me talk about missing and murdered indigenous women. In 2020, Deb Haaland, who is now the Interior Secretary, she was a congresswoman. And she teamed up with a couple of other congresswomen, and they pushed a bill forward in Congress called the Not Invisible Act. And it was to shine a light on missing and murdered indigenous women, missing and murdered indigenous peoples, and sex trafficking and that kind of stuff. But MMIW is kind of the acronym that we have for it. So they pushed this thing through, and it became law in October of 2020. That's 4 years ago, almost 4 years ago. And what's happened since then? A lot of paper. 3 years after they did this, the commission that was created as a part of this act, and this commission had almost 40 people on it, and it had Native judges and Native police chiefs and all the people who were really almost turned on their heads in terms of assimilated to American standards of jurisprudence and of law enforcement. And, you know, yeah, there were mental health folks and that kind of stuff involved in this commission. And so for 3 years, and I know how it works when you put together a committee like this, a committee of 40 people, there were probably five who did anything on it. I'm going to tell you right now, I just know how these things work. And it doesn't matter if it's a federal government or a state government, you put a commission with 40 people on it and there's five people doing the work. And that's my guess, and I think it's a pretty good guess. So it took them 3 years to put together a report. And that report came out in November of 2023, so last fall. This past month, the Department of Justice and the Department of Interior did a joint response to that commission report. And a lot of it is, you know, just all nice language about, oh, we need to do more. We need to have better coordination. We have to have this, and we appreciate the work of the commission. Well, here's the problem. Yeah, law enforcement is an issue. Any situation where you have violence against women or anybody, and nobody's ever convicted, and of course, why is that? Well, part of the whole thing is you have this jurisdictional boondoggle created because the federal government refuses to acknowledge that our land, our people are sovereign, and that we should have the right to protect our children, protect our women, protect our people, and inflict some sort of punishment on those, Native or non-Native, who do something to harm our people. I mean, they did a pilot program as a part of their Violence Against Women's Act, where they certain tribes that were that operated just white enough, I'm sorry, just American enough, they say, well, yeah, you got a decent court system, you got a decent police department, and you already have jails. Yeah, we'll let you prosecute white people who come onto your territory to commit crimes. Well, how's that going to work out? Because I guarantee the first white person with any money or any resources who gets convicted in a native court and sent to a native jail for any length of time is going to sue the crap out of the federal government for allowing them to be prosecuted by a non-U.S. sanctioned, essentially. Because, you know, here's the thing. The United States has had to play this, like, game about whether native police or native courts are extensions of their courts or whether they can just be recognized somehow. So for the most part, white people cannot be held accountable by native people for crimes against native people. A native police department cannot arrest and convict a white person for committing a crime on their territory. Yeah, in case you didn't know. So there's that. And of course, it doesn't just stop there. I mean, the problems, you know, just go through the roof in terms of, the contradiction and the chaos when it comes to state jurisdiction, federal jurisdiction, Bureau of Indian Affairs jurisdiction versus FBI. And then you get into the local, municipal, whether it's state police or whether it's county police. It's an absolute mess. But see, this is what we have. And of course, all along the way, we've got Disney making Pocahontas a sexy little thing on the TV screen for children and perverts to see and witness. And of course, tell an absolute fabricated story about her love affair with John Smith, which never happened. And to reinforce this idea that these big white guys just want this little Indian maiden for themselves. You don't talk about rape. You don't talk about kidnap. You make it a love story. There was no love story between a 12-year-old and a man she never met. I mean, it's the level of absurdity is just incredible. But here's the thing. For all of the jurisdictional problems, for all the law enforcement problems, for all the remoteness issues that exist on many Native territories, even a territory like where I live, which is only 30 miles away from Buffalo, there seems to be like a huge space between how law enforcement or how things are viewed in, say, the city of Buffalo versus on the Cattaraugus Territory of Seneca Nation. And there is not a whole lot of clarity that's offered on this stuff. But here's the thing. All the people who sat on the commission, there was not one person who sat on that commission whose job it was to address things like quality of life. Oh, yeah, there were mental health folks. But what about quality of life? What about opportunities? What about economic development? If you are a young person and you see that there's nothing for you on your native territory, and especially if your native territory is remote, you might reach levels of desperation to leave. And you know what? That's exactly what the federal government wants. They want native people to leave the territory, leave our quote-unquote reservations. We've heard, especially right-wing policymakers for decades say, the biggest mistake we ever made was creating the reservation system. Like, you created this thing for us? No, you didn't. It was the way that you could push us out of the way. Now, some of our territories, I live on the Cattaraugus Territory of Seneca Nation. It's not a reservation. It wasn't land set aside by the federal government. It is land that the Senecas actually hold the title to. Not a New York State deed, not a U.S. deed. They hold original title to the land that I live on. But that's not the case in some places. There's this overshadowing of the federal government on everything. You know, that ward of the state kind of thing? Well, if your land is held in trust by the federal government, it's a little hard to suggest that they aren't viewing you as some sort of inferior people that they have to be the custodians over. And therein lies part of the problem. Look, the poverty that exists on Native territories is not an accident. It's policy driven. It was created by the federal government. It was all part of a plan to starve us out. I mean, there was literally programs that the federal government had that was geared towards trying to get people to sever their ties to their native communities. They called it, the Relocation Act. It was a policy where they took a native person and they put them in a city. They put them in a city and they give them some crappy apartment and some crappy job and a commitment from them that they would stay there and work that job and then become a part of that lower level of society within those urban environments. And of course, they weren't nice homes and they weren't good jobs. There was no training involved. So this was all an effort to drive us off of our territories. Then we did silly things like started figuring out, well, you know, we can use our territories and the sovereignty of our territories, our regulatory advantage. We could sell tobacco without state tax on it. We could sell motor fuel without state tax on it. We could do gaming. We could do a few things. And that just pissed off the federal government. Because that was going to undermine the effort to make us leave our territories. And in some cases, you know, some territories developed, if not a level of affluence, certainly a level of sustainability. But that baked-in prejudice, that baked-in rape culture and objectification of our people, even as we put them to work put our own people in work in the casinos, sometimes that even opened the door even more. The other thing that opened the door even more are these man camps that came along with the oil and gas industry, the fossil fuel industry. Men that would leave their families in the East Coast or the West Coast and go off to the remote territory. This, you know, they could go up, you know, pretend that they were these rugged outdoorsmen and go to the wilderness where the only people close by are Native people. Well, that didn't play out very well for Native women. The amount of rape and violence that women and girls experience as a result of those man camps, that's not even documented properly. 4 years since the Not Invisible Act, and they've been shuffling paper and talking about organization and coordination and collaboration. They haven't done anything. They haven't funded anything, and they certainly haven't done anything to improve the quality of life, because if the quality of life improves on our territories, and you don't even have to give us anything. You just got to stop your regulations, stop interfering with our right to progress. The root causes of missing and murdered Indigenous women are not being addressed. And it doesn't just stop there. Look, I had as a guest on my Let's Talk Native podcast, and I encourage you to take a listen. I had Noel Bass, who produced first a short film called The Bears on Pine Ridge, and then now has produced a full-length motion picture documentary called The Bears on Pine Ridge, which is about a group that was put together by some incredible women to try to support or push back against the suicide problem that exists on Pine Ridge. Youth suicide was something that wasn't even, it was like, it didn't exist. Statistically, there was no such thing as youth suicide a couple of decades ago. But now you see young Black people and young Native people taking their lives at an alarming rate. Wait a minute. Didn't things change after the assassination of Martin Luther King? No, they didn't. That's the problem. We aren't addressing the root causes. We aren't addressing racism. If anything, you've got a guy who in all likelihood is going to be the president of the United States who is one of the most overt and devout racists that the country has seen in a century. I won't say of all time, because they were all racist as hell before that. I mean, look, slavery was legal in the United States. You can't talk about things like racism and ignore slavery. But, you know, the suicide problem that exists on our territory is a direct result of the conditions on our territory, the lack of hope, the hopelessness that young people feel. And that contributes to missing and murdered Indigenous women. It contributes to having households that are in a constant state of turmoil trying to make ends meet, which oftentimes leads to domestic violence. If we don't address some of that stuff, and look, I'm not saying just throw money at it, But I'm not saying don't. I mean, when people talk about reparations, one of the things that I keep saying over and over and over again is if you want to talk about truth and reconciliation as a way to resolve the residential school issue, the idea that our children were ripped out of our homes for 150, almost 200 years, and indoctrinated into the Christian faith, kind of, and they were literally tortured and punished and had the native identity beaten out of them. Don't talk to me about reconciliation. I'm not trying to love you now after all that. I'm not trying to say, oh, will you be my friend now? Can we put that behind us? No, I want restoration. I want payback. And I'm not just talking about a check. I'm talking about our autonomy. I'm talking about land back. I'm talking about our distinction, our identities, that we are allowed to restore our identities. Instead, we still got racist people all over the country who want to steal our identities for their high school mascot. In New York, and you know, I played a big role in getting the ban against schools using native mascots. Well, this past week, a couple of schools announced their new mascots here in the area. I live on Cattaraugus territory of Seneca Nation, which is near Buffalo. And just listening to these white people just lose their minds over the fact that they can no longer play Indian as a part of school. And these are guys who can't anyway because they graduated, or maybe not. They got out of school 40 or 50 years ago. But the most racist, I mean, I had people calling me down left and right on social media. And I got to admit, I probably bait them a little bit. Because I want people to realize that the underlying problem here is racism. And sometimes you got to flesh them out a little bit. And I had people saying that we were nothing but drunks, that we were a failed race. And that they should go ahead and change these because we don't deserve to be honored with these mascots. It was a mistake to do it in the first place. Well, it was a mistake, but not for the reasons you're saying. But yeah, this is the feedback I got from some of the kind white folks. And this is Buffalo, which was the site of the mass shooting at the Tops Friendly Market, where a white guy from downstate came up to or the southern tier of New York, I should say, Binghamton area, traveled all the way to Buffalo just to kill black people, and we're going to pretend that we're doing all this healing and that we're going to do all better. And of course, that was the other thing, by the way, when I saw the response from DOJ on this this commission for the Not Invisible Act. Oh, we need more healing. Well, I don't know what you guys consider healing, but if the quality of our lives don't get better, then there's no healing. You can't put a Band-Aid on cancer. You're the cancer. All right, you know what I'm going to do? Reg, can we take a few calls to close out the show? Is it possible we could do that? I don't know if I got Reggie listening. I'm sure I must put Reggie to sleep sometimes when he's... what is it? I catch him off guard with some of this stuff. If we can, then let's do that. Let me remind people that we are listener-supported radio, and we do need your support to be on the air. And I know, look, if you listen to the show and it feels like I'm beating you up every week, I'm not. I'm just trying to demonstrate my passion for these issues. And I'm hoping that some of you who listen feel moved enough to want to do something. And as I say, one small thing you can do is you can at least try to ensure that I have this space on these radio stations. So again, I ask that you support WBAI by going to their pledge line, 212-209-2950, or go online to give2wbai.org, or for WPFW in Washington, D.C., dial 202-588-9739 or go online to WPFWFM.org. We'd love you to be sustainable members, buddies, we call them at WBAI. I'd love to sign up a bunch of buddies, week in and week out. It would take a lot of pressure off of me. And I'm going to flat out tell you. Look, even... Nobody's giving me this space for free, or at least not for very long. If I don't carry my weight, especially on WBAI, there's a good chance they'll put somebody on here who generates money for them. I think I'm contributing something to the station. I think I'm contributing something to New York and to Buffalo and to wherever anybody's listening. But nobody's monetizing what I'm contributing by doing this on the air. Honestly, the only way they can measure is the money that comes into their station. So I ask that you consider supporting these two radio stations, WPFW in Washington, D.C., and WBAI in New York City. Like I said, I'm hoping we can do a few phone calls. Let me give the studio number. It is 212-209-2877. That's the number to call. Of course, we are live in New York City, and this show rebroadcasts in Washington on Fridays at 2 o'clock. So if you're listening live in New York City, you know what time we're on because you're listening live in New York City. And if you want to participate in this program, the number to call is 212-209-2877. And look, I hit some pretty heavy topics today, as I usually do. And I can't help it. I mean, this stuff is important. And I don't want, you know, it's great to do an MLK Day, but I don't know how you can do a Martin Luther King Day as a holiday and not specifically acknowledge the day that he was gunned down for being a peace activist. For being a peace activist. And like I said, 56 years ago, and all I can think about are the names of the people, other black men and women who were killed. Children, Tamir Rice, I mean, children killed by police officers because there's this embedded layer of racism, this idea that black people are a threat. Well, and Native people, we experience the same thing. You know, and it's always hard because even doing the event down in Mount Vernon this past weekend, I mean, I don't want to get into a competition about whose tragedy was worse, what Native people have experienced for several hundred years or what Palestinians have experienced since for the last 60 years or 70 years. I mean, it's tragic, especially when you look at women and children. I mean, it's tragic no matter what. My whole point in what I offered in this conversation, because we were talking about colonizations, I had to once again remind people, the United States support, their undying support, military support for Israel, regardless of how many people they murder with that military support, is not an anomaly. This is what the United States is and always has been. It was built on genocide and slavery. They call it colonization, but it's theft. It's flat out theft. Imperialism, colonization, exploration, all these great euphemisms for taking, for stealing, for murder. That's what they are. And we see it playing out in real time in the Gaza Strip. And nothing seems to change it. I mean, there's a good chance that Joe Biden is going to lose this next election to Donald Trump. And it doesn't get better because he gets elected. Of course it doesn't. But it doesn't get better with Joe Biden in there either. And that's why he's probably going to lose, some of the support he got the first time he ran against this monkey. So, again, Reg, are you within earshot at all? All right, maybe I don't have Reggie. That's okay. We'll go on. I was hoping to take a few callers to close out the show, but that's fine. Look, as I looked at some of this paperwork associated with the federal government addressing the missing and murdered indigenous women. Of course, one of the things that I can't help get away from is this notion that Deb Haaland, a Native woman who ran for Congress and initiated this Not Invisible Act bill in 4 years ago. But then she becomes the Interior Secretary. And what happens invariably is that we are led to believe that this was somehow a gift to us. Because they took a Native person and they stuck them in a cabinet position. I got to remind people, there was a vice president of the United States that was Native. Charles Curtis. I think it was for Calvin Coolidge, if I'm not mistaken. And he did nothing for Native people. In fact, the film Killers of the Flower Moon, the Osage, they reached out to Charles Curtis, I think while he was a U.S. senator, hoping that he could help get attention to what they were going through there. Didn't give him the time of day. Charles Curtis did more to separate Native people from the lands than both as a congressman and as a senator, and then would continue more of that work as a vice president. So putting a Native person in these positions just means that they've transitioned into this high level of indoctrination and assimilation into that system of government. Deb Haaland does not work for us. She works for Joe Biden. She works for the white man in the White House. That's what she does. Her first and primary role is to protect the interests of the United States, not to protect ours. Now, the hope is, because she's Native, that she would give a little more consideration to some of the issues that we face. But that's always a risky calculation. You know what? Look, when Deb Haaland got that position, they plastered her picture, her image, all over magazine covers. And they, oh, look how Native looking she is. How beautiful she is. Look at the clothing that she wears. Did you ever see anybody else in a cabinet position get plastered across magazines? Talk about objectification of Native women. That's exactly what Deb Haaland represented. Now, I'm not saying that there was, that it spurred on the rape culture. But why would that woman be objectified this way? And we fell for it. Native people fell for it. Oh, isn't that great? Isn't that great that there's a cabinet secretary that's Native? But you know what? She didn't do anything for the Senecas as they were fighting New York State over getting screwed out of billions of dollars in gaming revenue. The system is built a certain way. And joining that system, I'm not going to get into a conversation about whether anybody should vote or not. I look at this whole system and I realize that as I'm predicting that Trump will win the next election, he's still going to lose by 5 million votes. But he lost by 2 million when he beat Hillary Clinton in the popular vote. He only needed about 30 or 40,000 more votes, even though he lost the popular vote to Joe Biden by 7 million. Because the system is rigged. It's not rigged in the way Donald Trump says it's rigged. It's actually rigged in his favor. And it's not democracy. And I'm not even a fan of democracy. The reason I'm not a fan of democracy is because you basically have 50% plus one that gets to rule over 50% minus one. So it means you have a real big group of people who are not happy. It's rare that you have a landslide election. And of course, there's so very few people who participate in the United States in the electoral process, especially at the primary level and everything else, that it's a very small minority of people who are choosing your so-called leaders. And when you take one of ours, look, Obama did the same thing. He had two people, Kim Teehee and Jody Gillette, put in as his advisors. So he put some Native women in positions of power, right? I met with Jody Gillette. And I'm not saying we didn't accomplish anything meaningful, that we did. But I also saw how the Standing Rock thing played out. Jody Gillette was the sister to the chief or chairman or whatever he was, Dave Archambault out in Standing Rock. And he got played like a fiddle by the Obama administration. And you know what? When they were opposing the Dakota Access Pipeline, yep, it went through anyway. The pipeline's there. And it's had a few incidents already. So it didn't matter that 10,000 Native people showed up at Standing Rock. In the meantime, you had Dave Archambault, the tribal chairman or chief or whatever he was, leading his people, getting ready to do a fireworks display when they stopped, did a temporary halt on it. And you got his sister, who's advising the President of the United States. That community had more access to the President of the United States than any community any Native community in the United States. How'd that work out for them? It didn't. This is the system. And we need to change it. And I'm not saying that you can change the system by using the system. It's the whole idea of, you know, the master's tools, right? Look, when I pushed to get this ban on native mascots in New York State, I wasn't going to go to the state legislature. All those people caught up in their culture wars and their cancel culture, you know, dialogue and their, you know, kill DEI, diversity, equity, inclusion stuff, all the their culture wars. I wasn't going to play that game. I hoped that by pressing education folks, education professionals with the New York State Department of Education, that they would use intelligence and the ability to look at research and testimony and proof and evidence to make the right call. And they did. Now, they were silent for over 20 years. So it's not like they did a rush to judgment by any means. And they were in a hurry to make this thing just, but they did it. And they needed the right push. And I provided that push. I fought my old high school. And then I took my fight to my old high school, which is mentioned in the passage of this ban. If you read any of how it was that New York State got to this place where their education department decided to ban the use of native mascots, it starts with Cambridge Central School, my high school, the school that I fought to change their mascot. So you don't necessarily have to follow the path that they lay out before you. You got to find the holes in their system. You got to find their weak links. Look, the fact that Deb Haaland sits there in the Interior Department, by all means, I think that we should attack her because she should be their weak link because of her connection to Native people. But we're not even doing it. We're afraid to attack her. Look, this Bears on Pine Ridge, it's a group of young people that are led by an incredible woman by the name of Tiny DeCorey and her partner that she lost to cancer recently. And they literally play dress up. That's why they're called Bears, because they put on bear costumes or animal costumes and try to stimulate Native kids into feeling better about their lives in a place that sometimes that can seem hard to feel good about because of the poverty, because of the lack of resources. Every other place in the country, if you have a problem, you can call 988. You can call the hotline and get help immediately. That help is slow to come in Pine Ridge. The likelihood that if you ever get to that place where you're really contemplating suicide, you're not going to see any help. Possibly, you may reach your feels like your weakest point, but still muster up enough courage to say, I'm going to reach out to help, and then regret it every single day for the rest of your life, no matter how short that life is. Why? Because you didn't get to see a psychiatrist. You didn't get to see a therapist. You didn't get to see a medical professional who may have prescribed you something that could have helped. No, you don't see any of that stuff. You might sit in front of a computer screen and talk to somebody 300 miles away who doesn't have a clue what your life is like or what your life is about. They may not have a clue what it's like to be a Native person living on a Native territory in the world that was created by the United States. Not a clue. And it doesn't matter that Deb Haaland is the Interior Secretary. It doesn't matter that she was in Congress. They didn't put any money towards it. They didn't increase Indian Health Services funding so mental health could be addressed on our territories. And mental health is probably the biggest crisis that affects Native people. Why? Because of two centuries of trauma. Residential schools, being beaten as a child, being indoctrinated into a faith that wasn't yours, having your name changed, your hair cut, your identity stripped away. Knowing what was done to your ancestors, to your grandparents, your great-grandparents. Look, they were still murdering Native people with the military in the 1890s. Celebrated author, L. Frank Baum, author of The Wonderful Wizard of Oz, called for our extermination. He said, why not annihilation? their glory has fled, their manhood has been effaced. Better they die than live the miserable wretches that they are. He called for our extermination. In 1892. I mean, that's not that long ago, folks. And you know what? A week after he published that editorial in the paper that he ran, that he printed, was the massacre at Wounded Knee. Now, did he cause that massacre? I don't know. He certainly encouraged it. He called for our extermination. And exterminate is exactly what happened at Wounded Knee. December 20th, 1892. I mean, this is the reality. We know that we were stripped from our lands and moved to places that were almost unsustainable for lives. And then when they did find something of value, they ripped into our land for gold. They ripped into our land for uranium. They ripped into our land for coal. We have some of the hottest spots for cancer in any place in the country because of the contamination. They actually wanted to bury, in fact, they did bury nuclear waste on native lands. Why? Because we're sacrifice zones. That Dakota Access Pipeline we talked about, they could have run that across the state farther up north, but it would have been too close to a white population. They chose where they were going to cross the river there based on who lived there. Here on Seneca territory, Pittsburgh had a flooding problem. So they wanted to control the rivers that came into Pittsburgh. So they decided they're going to put a dam on the Allegheny River and condemn to a floodplain 10,000 acres of Seneca land. John Kennedy was running for president. He supported the idea. Why? Because he needed Pennsylvania to win the election. We're going to have to displace some Senecas, but if that's what it costs to get me elected, then that's what it's going to cost. He actually wrote an apology letter to the Senecas after the fact, after they bulldozed the homes and the farms and the villages in that 10,000 acres that got reduced to a floodplain. Why? To protect Pittsburgh from flooding. And there were better options. But what made this the best option was who lived there. So when you ask the question, why are the conditions like this on our territory? Why do we suffer with substance abuse? It's not because we're a weak race. It's because we've been battling this trauma for 200 years. From massacres to Kinzua and flooding our territories, the Dakota Access Pipeline, this stuff continues. Having your assets frozen by a Democrat governor in the state of New York, who takes $2 billion from the Seneca people that need that money because it's essentially their only source of public finance. New York has all kinds of other ways of generating. Hell, $2 billion to New York State is almost nothing. It's a lot to 8,000 Seneca people. It's a lot to 8,000 Seneca people. So if you're wondering why the trauma exists, it's U.S. policy. It's U.S. policy that's created that trauma. So when you look at the legacy of colonialization from Mount Vernon to Palestine, well, it's not just a legacy in terms of looking back. It's a legacy because it continues. I want to thank you for joining me this week. I think I'm off in New York next week, but I will still be on WPFW. Look, I'm going to relaunch. I mentioned this before. I'm going to relaunch my Let's Talk Native podcast. I'm going to treat it a little bit more like a weekly show. Haven't firmed up what date I'm going to be doing it on and what hours I'm going to be operating it. But look for that coming soon, too. I'm John Kane. This is Resistance Radio. Thanks for listening. Yahweh.